The following interview took place at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. A Recovering Skinhead Story with Frank Mink, interviewed by Rabbi Yaakov Fellig and Rabbi Benny Liu.
The wise King Solomon wrote, "Death and life are in the power of the tongue." The tongue is indeed a powerful tool, but a soul is more powerful. It drives an orator of death to transform into an advocate for all life. As a white supremacist skinhead member of the KKK, Frank Minken ran his own talk show called The Reich. Frank was the tongue of the American neo-Nazi movement. But acts of divine providence fed a stubborn internal conscience that led him to shatter the shackles of indoctrination. Amazingly, Frank is now a forceful lecturer against hate and a vocal power for interracial harmony. His incredible journey was not easy, as Frank will tell you himself.
My name is Frank Mink, and I'm from South Philadelphia. I was born and raised actually in an all-Irish Catholic neighborhood in a pretty hard little part of Philly. It was me and my mom, single mom, on welfare. You know, I remember having food stamps as a kid, having the food coupons, which the government gave you, and I remember having to walk into a store as a kid in the corner delis where everyone down there knows your business. We're all related. Like, somehow we're all second and third cousins from each other, so everyone knows your business. I remember struggling. I remember my mom struggling. I remember my mom in and out with drugs and alcohol. So my mom gets remarried. Now, we were raised Catholic, actually. And, you know, you had to make all your sacraments as a kid. Like, to live in our neighborhood, you had to go to the church. You had to make your sacraments. You had to go to catechism. But it wasn't, you know, what they say about the people that go for high holidays. Like, we went on Christmas and Easter was the only one we went to church. So, my mom gets remarried to a man who is also a drug addict, alcoholic, who did not like me at all. And he moved in when I was about 8, and I was basically abused by this man until I was 13. By the time I was 13, I'm getting in trouble at school. I'm getting kicked out of school. I'll fast forward just a little bit, just to give you a good example of what it was like living in that home with that man. When I would go home from school, which my school is only 2 blocks from my house, every day, and I mean this, every day I would plot and plan to get hit by a car. I was like, because if I just get hit by a car, I don't have to go home. Like, I don't want to die. Everyone in South Philly gets hit by cars. I mean, it's the things you do in those little small, you know, it's always your family members that run you over, so you can't sue them. You just get hit by a car and go to a hospital, and that's all I wanted, is just not to go home. And I was too fast. As the cars would come, I don't get out of the way every time, and it felt like a Biggest Loser. Like, I can't even get hit by a car. Like, I really felt that way. Literally, really felt that way. So anyway, my stepdad finally gets what he wants. He makes me move. I move with my dad. My dad lives up in Southwest West Philly. I don't know if any of you guys ever see Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Will Smith, you know, where he sings a song in the beginning. West Philly, born and raised on the playground where I spent most of my days chilling out, Matt, anyway. It's a really rough neighborhood. It's rougher than my mom's. And I went to an all-black school where there was 20 of us, not 20%. 20 of us that went to the school, 20 white kids. And you better believe we brawled and fist fought and watched your back and all that stuff. And I wound up playing on the sports teams, which got me out of a little bit of trouble because I made some friends with some of the kids on the sports teams there. But it was not, and my dad's place was horrible. My dad had a bar and he sold cocaine and it was horrible. Electric would be shut off. Hated it. And that summer, I got to get out of my family's home, out of my dad's house. My mom's brother and sister lived up, and they moved up to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. I don't know if any of you know the Lancaster, Pennsylvania area. It's like the hub of the Amish. I mean, that is their turf. You go up there, and they really ride horse and buggies. They really turn butter. Like, they don't wait for a tourist to come and go, oh, my God, now it's turned butter. they really turned butter. Like, I mean, that stuff's that was National Geographic stuff. Out of this, I was like going to Africa. It was so crazy to me. But I love my family that was up there. They weren't Amish. They were old South Philly people that moved out of the neighborhood. So anyway, my cousin who was up there, he was the year before, because I had gone up the summer before and did the same thing, spent the whole summer up there on the farm and loved it. And he was a punk rocker. I mean, real punk rock. I was in the punk rock that year. So this summer, I thought I was going to go up and he was going to be in the punk rock. And I walk into his room and his room looked different. He had a swastika flag, a Confederate flag. He had pictures of Hitler on his wall and little newspaper articles about neo-Nazi skinheads this, neo-Nazi skinheads that. And then my cousin came home, and he came with some of his friends. And they were all shaved bald. They all looked different from this year before. They just looked different. And they had tattoos. And I just turned 14. They were 16, 17-year-olds. To me, that's super cool. And they were tattoos, they had fighting stories, they had beer, and then they started to hang out with me. And when those guys would sit around, and I'll just make this as fast as possible, when those guys would sit around and they would say things like, multiracial society doesn't work. I'm 14 years old. I have no idea what that word even means. But when they start talking about blacks and whites not getting along, I'm like, you guys have no idea. You live around Amish people. Like, I have to take the L train every day. Are you out of your mind? And so my cousin happened to back me up to these older guys and said, yo, my little cousin right here, man, he lives in a really rough neighborhood. And these big bad, to me, big bad neo-Nazis would always be like, yo, what's it really like? What's it like? Do you really take the train with black people, you know? And I said, yeah, every day. And when those guys would ask me those questions, yo, I could come home with either my parents' house, my mom or my dad's crib. I can come in with a black eye, a trophy from a sporting event. My parents never, hey, how'd you get that? Hey, how'd you get the black eye, Frank? Yo, is everything okay at school? Never. That's not my parents' parenting style. And when these guys would ask me, what's it like growing up around black people? It was someone saying, how's your day? And I love that. Someone was asking me. So real quick, when we would go to these little, now I'm a little skateboarder. I got a little skateboarder haircut. They used to call it the teardrop haircut. I had it going on. We would go to these nightclubs, and I'm with these big shaved tattooed guys, and everyone was afraid of them. Everyone in the club was afraid of them. And they would be meeting up with other neo-Nazis that I didn't know, and my cousin would have to tell them, hey, this little guy with the little hair on his head, he's one of us. Don't beat him up. Because they would just go in and beat people up. I'm going to tell you that when we would stand outside of a nightclub and I see how everyone feared them, man, up until I might be a 14-year-old kid. I stopped mentally growing when my stepdad moved in. I really did. So I was really a fearful 9-year-old little boy who was scared of my parents, scared of my step-parents, scared of my school, scared if I was going to have enough food to eat. And now people fear me because I'm with these guys. Loved it. Loved it. And so to get to the part where I go to this first little rally, this first little get-together, I shave my head, I get involved, and I go to this thing. And like growing up in my neighborhood, you know, it was Irish. So we talked about everybody else, right? The Irish, no matter how low down on the scale we could have been, at least we're not them. At least we're not them. At least we're not the Cambodians. At least we're not the blacks. At least we're not the Italians. Like, and the Italian kids said the same thing about us. The black kids said the same. You know, it's just that little ethnical thing that we want. But the one thing I'd always hear was, I remember like my uncle, when I was a little boy, I would hear things like my uncle come home and be like, yo, I went to the corner deli today and Michael didn't give me back the right change. He tried to Jew me. And everyone laughed. Everyone laugh, and I didn't get the joke. And or, how do you start a Jewish parade? You roll a penny down the street, huh? And everyone laugh. And I never got the joke as a kid. So I remember going to my uncle one time and said, why is that funny? Like, when you said Johnny tried to Jew you, what's that mean? And he said, well, Frank, see, the Jews and money, and he goes, you know what? You'll get it when you're older. You'll get the joke when you're older. It's a good joke. When I went to my first neo-Nazi get-together, the guy starts talking about how Israel and the Jews secretly siphon money from the Federal Reserve, give it to Israel to start the next world war. Now, I'm 14 years old and you're talking about the Federal Reserve. I'm 48 years old, I still don't know what you're talking about, the Federal Reserve. But you know what I mean? I'm like, all right. But what happened was, it unlocked the joke in my head. And I must be older. because I get what my uncle was talking about. And that was very powerful, that I got to know knowledge that the adults know, who left me to fend for myself. Now I know what they know. And that's when I fully came in. Obviously, Hashem had plans for me for a long time. No matter, he had given me gifts, and I've always been able to give people into whatever I was into. When I was a kid, I would get the best hockey team in my neighborhood. I would get the best group of friends, the toughest little group of friends. Like, I always had a good little way of doing that. Just was one of those people. And now when I had to go back to my neighborhood after I joined this neo-Nazi group, I had to go back into my mom's neighborhood, to go back to live with my dad sometimes. I start recruiting all the kids in that neighborhood because they already had the little neighborhood racism. So racism is the biggest bait and switch ever pulled. Because what I would do to people, and now I don't know that I was doing this. I thought I was doing the right thing. Racism, the way that you recruit is like this. A guy says, I wouldn't be proud to be white. Why can't I be proud to be white? I'm going to be called a racist. I just want to be proud to be white. And I say, yeah, man, that's what we're all about. That's what we're all, come to our meetings. That's what we're all about. And then you come to our meeting, guess what? We never talk about being proud of being white. We talk about y'all. We talk about them. We talk about those people. We talk about how they're messing everything up. Because you can only talk about Leif Erikson so much. You know what I mean? So it was like this whole big thing that it's a bait and switch. You think you want to be proud of your race, but it's really their problem. It's their fault. And it works. And it works still to this day. So I got really good at recruiting. I got my own TV show. I went into prison. I got into prison at 17 years old. So if I caught you up in a little bit of my life. Do you have any other questions?
How long were you in prison for?
I got sentenced to three years, and I did about a year and some change. I was the youngest kid in the prison for a minute, and then a couple other kids wound up showing up. I was 17 years old when I got to this adult maximum security prison. I was in the same prison with John Wayne Gacy, if any of you guys remember that guy. Same prison with him. He killed 33 17, 18, 19-year-old boys, and I'm in the same prison. I went to prison not worrying about that. It wasn't something, I remember not worrying about him at all. Like he had so many death hits put out on him that he was locked up in death row and all that. But I remember getting to that prison and going, wow, they must really think I'm a bad human being. You know, and I was. I mean, I just got done, I kidnapped an Antifa member and held him for ransom. You know, that's how he handled my business. So yeah, they had some issues with me.
So I have a personal question,
mm-hmm.
which I'm sure everybody here would be interested in anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So for the last 20 years, I've been in and out of prison every day. I've been working in a prison, maximum security, and I deal pretty much every day with neo-Nazis, skinheads, Odinists, all those people.
Mm-hmm.
My question to you is, now you're in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, I'm in California.
Mm-hmm.
When I go to this prison, to this institution, I wonder what you see in the religious programming or the chaplaincy and so on. Would you be able to answer that?
Like the different chaplains that come in and all that? Like,
so how do you look at religion?
In prison,
yeah.
Or now? In prison?
In prison,
actually, I went to like a bunch of Bible studies in there. And it was, I'm going to be honest. I was 17 years old, and I was just trying to make it in this world. I knew that they always had free cookies and coffee. So I was like, I'm down. I'll go listen for a little bit. You know what I mean? What's up with that? So, and actually, when we would go to the religious services, you would always put the gang stuff to the side. Like, you weren't allowed to bring that in. If there was a reverend coming in or someone, you had to put everything to the side. No gang affiliation, no throwing up signs in there, no spouting views, no arguing, because we would have a lot of the Muslim guys that come in sometimes and want to argue with the minister that would come in and about the truth on that. And we'd always say, nah, this ain't the place. Like, it's a neutral ground. So it was neutral there. So that was always the good. And you got free cookies.
Free, ate the free cookies.
I just want to ask you, when did you meet your first Jew?
There was one or two kids that went to my mom's, when I lived in my mom's neighborhood, which used to be Jewish. It's a whole long story that I found out later on. It's how come I found out I was Jewish. But the neighborhood had changed. But there was a couple kids, but I didn't know anything like that. I just knew one or two kids that I knew. Later on, I heard, oh yeah, Eddie Harvey was Jewish. And I didn't know that. Everyone in our school was Irish. You were either Irish or not Irish. That was it. Like, so, but I'll tell you what, when I was getting out of the movement, so I went to prison, played basketball, played cards. Again, I was a white kid from Philly in Southern Illinois. I was in the maximum security joint in Southern Illinois. So all my Aryans, because I was I used to have a big swastika on my neck. So when I got in, I'm already in the gang, don't have to initiate in. They all knew I had a cable access show. I was kind of well-respected. I don't mean to sound egotistical, but I was very well-respected when I got there. So I had tons of protection. I was totally fine. So I get up there, and I'm starting to play sports with, because when, look, all the biker, they were all my white friends in prison were bikers. I'd never been on a Harley in my life, right? But with the black kids from Chicago, talked about taking the L train, talked about that type of life. So I kind of got along a little bit with them. Now I'm getting to the where I met my Jewish guy here is. When I got released from prison, just from the time I spent in there, I remember when I got out, I wanted to stay part of the neo-Nazi movement. I was having a little bit of different feelings, but not my, like, my ego and everything was wrapped in that. I had tons of pull, whatever. So I remember when I got back to Philly, I started saying, you know what, I'm not going to talk really about black people or Latino people or Asian people. I'm still just going to talk about the Jews. Like, and I'll still be part of this group. Like, and, you know, and that's, I'll stick to that. So, and of course, Hashem just has other plans. As I'm trying to find a job, and if any of you in here that have a company or work or hire people, when a person like me shows up with a swastika on my neck, stuff written on my knuckles, and an aggravated kidnapping for life already on my record, and I'm filling out a job application at your business, these ain't good people skills, you know what I mean? They're not like swastika, management, definite, you know what I mean? They don't say that. So a buddy of mine said he can get me a job when I first got back to Philly for $100 a day, carrying in antique furniture at the Cherry Hill, New Jersey Mall. And my buddy says, yo, get your job, it's $100 a day, plus you'll make some tips. Do you want the job? And I said, man, I'll take it. And then as soon as I said that, he goes, Joe, but the guy that owns the company, he's a Jew. You still want the job? And I was like, okay. I was like, I don't care. And I said, but did you tell him about me? You know, because I'm still shaved bald with a swastika now. I said, did you tell him about me? And he goes, oh, yeah, I told Keith Brookstein all about you. And he said, he doesn't give a rat's ass what you believe. Just don't break his furniture. And I showed up, and I worked for this man. And I worked that whole weekend, and he was a big Philadelphia Flyers fan. I'm a big Flyers fan, so anytime we had any awkward moments where it was like me and him carrying a hutch together, how about them Flyers? Yeah, how about, you know, he's like, how about the weather type? You know, we didn't know what to talk about. But at the end of the weekend, I had made $600 in tips. I knew he knew that. So when it came to him paying me on Sunday night, I had already, and look, this doesn't have to be anti-Semitic, this could be all any human being. You know how we plot fights with people sometimes where you're like, you know what, if he's going to say that same stuff again, I'm going to say this, and you look in the mirror and you think of the fight, or you're driving into work and you're like, oh, I'm going to say this, I know he's going to say that, and you plot the whole fight out. I did that with him, thinking he's not going to pay me the $300 he owes me because he knows I made $600. So when he comes up to me at the end of the night and he says, yo, do I owe you some money? I'm like, yeah, you do. And he said, how much? I said, $300. And he said, you made tips? I said, yeah, I made tips. Yeah, I'm waiting for the fight, waiting for the landmine. And he said, hold on. Pulls out a lot of money that he made, and he said, here's 100, here's 200, here's 300. You know what? You're a really good worker. Here's an extra $100. And all I thought about, I'm broken sometimes. All I thought about was, you son of a gun, I had a fight waiting for you. You know what I mean? So anyway, he says, hey, can I give you a ride from Cherry Hill back to South Philly tonight, as the subways weren't running that late, you know, whatever. So I'll give you a ride. He would give me a ride back over to my thing. He starts telling me about how he used to live in my neighborhood in the 50s and how that there was this old synagogue by my house. And I was like, oh, I remember that old abandoned building, you know. And we were just talking, and he goes, so he's like, yeah, I used to live down here. So you don't have to, because I was giving him directions. He's like, you don't need to tell me, you know. As we're driving, he stops the truck right before he drops me off, and he's looking at me, and he says, what do you do for a living? And now the swastika is blazing in his face. He's the driver. I'm the passenger. He's like, right here. So I'm like, I don't do anything. And he says, why don't you come work for me? And I went and I worked for that man for about 6 months. And now I'm still trying to hold on to this last neo-Nazi belief. I'm trying to hold on, God. I mean, it was my everything. It was my everything. I would do things like the O.J. Simpson trial was going on at the time. So me and him, I would drive in a truck. He had tons of other employees, but he always let me drive in a truck with him. Like, me and him were kind of like the go-get-the-furniture guys, bring it back to the warehouse guys. Now, it's his company. And then I would read parts of the Philadelphia Daily News to him, and we'd talk about the O.J. Simpson trial and DNA and life. And I still have a thing, because I have a broken ego, is that anyone that's a neo-Nazi, anyone that's in that group, you have something's wrong with you. There is. I would break something. If I broke something, I'd always go, yo, I'm so stupid. You know, you hear that a lot of inmates. They have that whole, I'm so stupid. No, I can't do that. I'm stupid anyway. Because I've been pounded in my head from my parents. I'm stupid. I was going to be a ditch digger, was their words to me. I was going to be a ditch digger my whole life. So when I would break something, one time I broke a marble top table, and I looked over at Keith, and I was like, yo, dude, I'm so sorry. I'm so stupid. And he came over, and he was a little stocky little dude, you know, and he grabbed me by my neck, and he said, stop saying you're stupid, you idiot. Let's go. Let's go. And he said, pick it up. Let's go. And so I cleaned up this marble top table I broke. We get into the truck. We're driving through, and I'm sorry if anyone's from New Jersey. If you take this to heart, I'm so sorry. You're called the Garden State, but more like a Turnpike State. So we're driving down the turnpike, and he just starts unloading on me, saying about how if I think I'm the most stupidest person in the world, and if I keep saying this about myself, and he's like, I think you're one of the most brilliantest people I've ever met. The way you break this down, the way you talk about this, you're a smart dude. And he's like, so I'm tired of you saying it. And then he said these words that have stuck with me to this light. And there's interviews with me and Keith that are on YouTube and stuff. He said these magic words to me. He said, Frank, smart people can fake being dumb, but dumb people can't fake being smart. You just are. And I got out of that truck. You know? I got out of that truck with that man, and this part always gets me because you guys don't understand. You don't understand. If they would have gave me, when I was in a compound in Idaho, when I was in a compound in this group in Indiana, in Illinois, in Pennsylvania, and they would have said, Frank, here's the keys to a truck where there's a bomb back there, drive it to this location, I would have said, absolutely, absolutely. That's how down I was for this. And now I'm walking out of this truck with this man, walking back to my mom's house, and just knowing this is wrong. Like, I'm 100% wrong. Like, it's hard for a person like me to admit that I'm 100% wrong. And I felt like I was banging my head against the wall to believe these beliefs anymore. Because just so you know, in all of them, let's just use America as an example. And America is full of these type of racists that I make an exception racist. I hate all black people. They're all this way. Oh, except for this guy and that guy and the guy I work with and the guy I went to school with and that guy. And he's cool because I know his family, but he's cool. But the rest of them are all this way. I hate all Latinos, except for this guy and this guy and this girl, because we've met and we're cool, I know them. But the rest of them are all the way I picture and imagine they are. I hate it being the guy who made the exceptions to be a racist anymore. And that's what I became. I was just making exceptions anymore. Just to back up my fears, because it's all fear. So Keith was the final guy where I'd stop becoming part of this. And didn't even know I was Jewish yet. Still didn't know. Had no idea when this all happened. Like, that's the funniest thing about it. And so so that's the Jewish
was it
guy.
Was it easy to get out?
So it wasn't. They jumped me at a funeral one night. I didn't mean to. I'm not one of those guys. Like, you know, some gangs, if you want to get out, you got to go get jumped out. Not this dude. You got to catch me. You know, you ain't jumping me out of nothing. But they caught me at a funeral one night and beat me up pretty good and threw me down a flight of steps. And then, you know, tons of death threats. I get death threats now. Just for any of you guys, you want to look this up, just in 2020, I testified in front of the United States Congress about a bunch of my neo-Nazi friends. This isn't a theory, y'all. A bunch of my neo-Nazi friends all became cops. They even had a band called the Arresting Officers, a music band, where they sang songs about kicking in the heads of Jews and immigrants, and they all became cops. So they asked me to go testify, and when I did, they started threatening my life. Not just the neo-Nazis, so the other people too. So anyhow, that just happened in my life. I had to go live on a boat for 2 years during the pandemic, so they couldn't find me. That just can't happen to me. So that's still going on in my life today.
What would you say to your 17-year-old self?
It's funny you ask, what would I say? I'm actually helping with, there's a book being written right now. I'm not trying to promote the book at all. People had asked me to take part of it, and it's a bunch, me and other former radicals and former gang members like that have done infamous crimes. They come and ask us, can you all write a letter back to your 17-year-old self? So I'm in the middle of writing that right now. So funny, did you know that?
Absolutely not.
No, okay. What I would say to myself is that the world isn't out to get you, and that the world isn't about you. Like, the world isn't about you, Frank. And for the longest time, I thought the world was about me. I thought the world revolves around me. And that fear that comes with that. The other thing I would say is that, you know, you just don't know everything. Some of the greatest things, and now at 17, I was still a neo-Nazi. To say that some of the greatest things I've now learned in my life are from rabbis. Some of the greatest things I've ever learned in my life now that have changed the way I act, the way I think, the way I treat the world, so to be a little bit more open-mindedness, to have a more open-mindedness, and that, man, there's a lot I would say to myself. I'd say get clean and sober as soon as possible. That'd be another thing. You know, one of the other things that goes along with being a radical and radicalized and stuff is that, you know, drugs and alcohol is definitely a part of my story. I grew up in a neighborhood where drinking was accessible. Drinking was everything. And over the last 5 years, 4 years now, where my recovery's become a vital part of my life, along with my Judaism, the best way I can describe it is for the first time in my life, I felt it zippering up, where I felt the teeth coming together in my life, you know? And that's from the practices that I do in both things, in my recovery and in my Judaism. Like, it just zips together. So
if you were interviewing a neo-Nazi, mm-hmm. skinhead, whatever you want to call them, what would you say to them?
If I was interviewing?
Today, if you were to sit in front of one of them, what would you say?
The first thing I would say, because today a lot of it is online, so I have a good... So I, for the last 25 years, I've done interventions on neo-Nazis, was one of the... You know, sounds easy. One of the leading people around the world doing that. The thing that I always get people with today is when I start to talk to them, I say, "Well, where'd you get that information?" "I got it online. They got everything online. I got it online." I always say, by the time you go down any rabbit hole, that when you're going on the computer, you want to look something up. By the end, are you in a rabbit hole of everything that you're reading is about other people? Or are you reading things about how you could be a better person? That's the difference. Because if when you go down the rabbit hole of, oh my God, you know, they're doing this to me and they're doing this to my community or they're saying this, then you've gone down the wrong rabbit hole. But if you're starting to read, like Rabbi Friedman was here. I just got to say hi to him. Like, you just don't, when I was on that boat, I watched every one of his videos. Every one of his videos. I really did. It was amazing to know he was here and get to see him and meet him for the first time. That was the rabbit holes I started going down because I knew it was about me. Like, that's the greatest things that Judaism taught me is humility, humbleness, some discernment in my life, stuff I never had before. You know, I'll tell you guys this, and hopefully you'll get it. I think you'll get it. When I was in the neo-Nazi world, the thing that they always talked about back then, before they called it the deep state, they called it Zog. I don't know if you ever heard of Zog. It's called the Zionist Occupational Government. That's the people they say were siphoning money off of the Federal Reserve, right? They throw the word Zog around all the time. I mean, the Zionist Occupational Government. So what in all these groups, and they're uniformed, and what they believe is that there's 10 old Jewish men who get together, and they run the whole world. They truly believe that. And to know that, like, that's... I know that that stuff's not true, right? When I hear stuff like since I got bit by that snake and that venom of anti-Semitism, my body has built up an anti-venom to it. See, when they talk about, well, the Jews are the head of this, and the Jews are the head of that, and the Jews are ahead of this, and I go, we're also the head of a lot of medical. We're also the head of a lot of addiction facilities. There's Jews everywhere because we have a heritage of learning. It's just the truth. For 4,000 years, there's been a heritage of learning. when my Irish ancestors, because I still have the Irish blood in me, 400 years ago, we were still trying to dig up potatoes. It's not being negative to them. I'm not. It's just being real. But for the last 4,000 years, we're reading Proverbs and trying to learn, get better and get wisdom to make this world a better place. Yeah, we're going to be achieving things. It's just the truth. And so when I've been able to talk to guys about stuff like that and point out some stuff that's reality, that's what I do with them.
Have you ever succeeded?
What's that?
Did you ever succeed?
All the time. All the time. There's not many that don't get out. I mean, I still talk to a lot of them to this day. I mean, I work with them just like a person working with someone in recovery of drugs and alcohol. I stay in touch with them. We, you know, come back over. Have to remind them a lot that, like, yo, you're not perfect, because that's, you know. So, you know. So, yeah, it's succeed. It's not that hard. Like, their rhetoric is not that easy to dispel, really. Especially when it's someone who's been there. It's just the truth, because when they're like, well, I just want to be proud of the white race, and I'm like, dude, you're an alcoholic and you're living in your mother's trailer right now. Come on. Come with me here now. You know what I mean? Like, you're not the master race, y'all. I mean, no one is, and I don't mean, and nobody is. So, and then when they're like, yeah, you're right. So I'm like, yeah, so every time you throw the N-word out, it makes you feel better because the two other dudes in the trailer down there are black from you. And so you get to now look it down at them. And it makes you feel better about yourself, even though your car's broken down out in front of your mom's trailer right now. So, and I get it. Here's the best words I get to hear a lot. And I don't mean to sound arrogant, as I always hear this a lot. Yeah, you're right, Frank. Just so you guys know that I got out of the neo-Nazis in the early 90s. Oklahoma City bombing changed me to where I wanted to go help. I was already out of the neo-Nazis in 1995 when the bombing happened, just so I give you the timeline. So I don't know that I'm Jewish until 2016. How did I find out? Okay. I was doing a documentary in Iowa about how Iowa is religiously diverse. I know that sounds weird when you think of Iowa, but the oldest standing mosque in all of North America is Mother Mosque number one in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. It's the oldest Muslim mosque in the world, in North America. It's crazy, right? It's in Iowa. Iowa has all these little things. So anyway, I got kind of hired to do this documentary about this. So I had some friends in Chabad who said I was knew some of the that a restaurant there, and I became friends with Rabbi Jacobson. And so I said, "Yo, I'd love for you to do this documentary with us, and go eat at his restaurant." So we show up, and as soon as we get there, he goes, "Frank, are you finally going to tell the world that you're Jewish?" Now he knows that I have a book out about being a neo-Nazi. He knows I've done all this work, and he knows the work I do. So he's like, "Are you finally going to tell the world that you're Jewish?" And I'm like, I'm not. And because he'd always say that to me. He's always like, you look Jewish. He used to always say that to me. And I'm like, I'm not. And he's like, your last name, Mink. He's like, it's the three vowels together. He's like, you really should look in. He's like, I think it's Ashkenazi. You should look into it. So then I put it on Facebook. Of course, on Facebook. Put it on Facebook about this. And my uncle chimes in. My uncle on my mom's side, who when I was first, now I didn't remember this until he brought it to my attention. I do remember once he brought it to my attention. When I was first becoming a neo-Nazi, he came to me and said, you can't be a neo-Nazi. We got Jewish blood in us. But I didn't believe him because he's just one of those uncles who would just say anything to bust my chops. You know what I mean? Like I just didn't believe him. So I was like, whatever. And I never even thought about it again. So I put it on Facebook. I said, hey, the rabbi said this about our last name. And my uncle writes back, I told you this years ago. All right? And I was like, all right. So then we did some more diving into it and find out, yeah, like my mother's great-great-great-grandmother, she was Jewish and then married into the Catholics, to the Catholics there in Philly, and then also my grandfather, where we get the last name, that the last name is actually Jewish. So I was like, all right. So I accepted it. And then a couple years later, I did a DNA test and found out, I'm a small amount, but it was enough.
How did it change you, knowing that you were Jewish?
Well, at the time, and this is, I don't want to get too deep and too long into the story, but at the time, I was really struggling with spirituality. I don't knock other religions. I'm not going to never knock. But there was just things that were not gelling with me. with what I came from. There's just things that weren't gelling anymore, and I've been really struggling with that. And then once I went to go take that leap, things just all started falling in the right place. They just did. So then I'll tell you a real quick funny story. In 2010 or 2011, I was at a recovery place where people in recovery meet, and I was there. This was in California. This was in out in the valley. And a man came over to me. We got introduced, and a man came over to me out of the blue, and he goes, now this is his word, so don't get mad. But he came up to me and goes, huh, a fellow Heeb at a meeting with me. Or sorry, that's where we were. He goes, huh, fellow Heeb at the meeting, huh? And I looked at him. Now, again, at the time, didn't know. I told him the same thing. I'm not Jewish. I'm actually living in L.A. making a TV show about doing interventions on neo-Nazis. I'm not Jewish. And he was like, yeah, you look like you are to me, right? And he just walked off. That man is now my recovering rabbi. That is the man I talk to every morning. After I wrap my tefillin, he's the first man I call every morning. So.
A number of years ago, I interviewed Rabbi Lau who was the ex-chief rabbi of Israel. The same setup here on the stage, and we're asking questions. And the student had asked me, when I came up, he said, do me a favor, would you ask the rabbi, because I'm on a campus and we have a lot to deal with, a lot of anti-Semitism, how would you deal with anti-Semites? Mm-hmm. So he turns around to me, Rabbi Lau, and if you know him, he has a very, very strong accent, and he speaks with a lot of force. And I asked him, said, what would you do if you came, to a shul or to your dormitory and you saw a swastika on the wall? He says, a swastika? I would not take it down. What I would do is I would put an equal sign next to the swastika and write the word failure. And then I would put a Magen David and put an equal sign that says success. And I would never take it down. That was his response.
Just to dovetail on that. So I work in a maximum security prison, and I deal, as I spoke about, with neo-Nazis every day. And one of the things I've noticed personally is there's a lot of questions, and more so than anything else, when you just take that time, when you explain to them, when you speak with them, you bring that human element into the conversation, they're listening. And I know because some of them have gone out and they're still keeping that proper pathway. They send me regards and all that. And it's like anything else. You do intervention. That's mostly communication, explaining teachings and living a certain way. Mm-hmm. And people, anybody, they accept what you say, what you do, if you're sincere. And when you're living that life sincerely, like I do, I go to the prison, I look like this. I look different to every single other person in that place. There is nobody who has a beard, a yarmulke, tzitzis, and all that within probably a 100-mile radius of where I work. Certainly not within my prison. Mm-hmm. But this is who I am, and they respect that. Even the neo-Nazi who came to me and asked me, why do I hate you? Those were his actual words to his question, why do I hate you? And I said, challenge accepted, have a seat. And I worked with him during the course of the next probably about year or two. He's now outside of prison. He's no longer a neo-Nazi. So I think what you're saying is great. But we all have that. When you speak with people, when you bring humanity into it, but you live it, the message is there, it's clear, and people follow.
Right.
I would just like to tell the audience that, there's a book that's being sold called The Book of Jewish Knowledge that JLI put out, took 7 years to put together. And recently, it's being translated, they found someone in Germany to translate it into German, because they did a study in Germany in high schools where they're required to teach about the Holocaust, that when they changed the subject from discussing it about the Holocaust and talking about who Jews are and how they live their lives, not how they get killed and how they get persecuted, but how they live their lives as Jews, it improved the attitude that the students had towards Jews. So one of the members of JLI, Rabbi Vogel, found someone in Germany who was willing to underwrite the translation of this book into German, and they're going to be doing it, giving it to in schools and high schools, because they believe that if they can show how we live our lives, what our traditions are, and show what Jews are, not when they're persecuted and dying, but rather how they live and when they're alive and living, that it has an enormously positive impact, and it changes their attitude towards Jews. And the Rebbe, by the way, used to always speak about that the more you look like a Jew, and the more you live like a Jew, and the more you behave like a Jew, that is the answer to anti-Semitism. And now we have the data to prove that that's absolutely true.
Right.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you. One person in our community was murdered by a 20-something-year-old. Recently, we've had a couple of attacks. We had an attack on a rabbi by a teenager, neo-Nazi. And I have a question, I'm not sure there's an answer to that. How can we protect ourselves? What is the best thing to do? Is it to start having, opening our doors to start telling neo-Nazi groups how we live as Jews? Yeah. What is the answer to that?
No, you know what? I mean, I'm not being a Jew, you know, we're not, I would never say invite groups of neo-Nazis here, never. I love that, but the way that this is going to work and the way that it does work is by having those Me Too moments with each other, is that not just one-on-one, will never change them in a group, but it's when, no matter if it's a neo-Nazi, whoever's sitting there, and they say, like, you know, one time I did this, and when you go, I did that too. You know, when they feel so bad about something they did in life, or it's about those Me Too moments. It's just about that one-on-one human connection. We can't change them in a group. That will never work, because the group is what keeps them fueled, and they keep that hate and that fear fueled. So, I mean, you know, unfortunately, like, there's a billboard that says, does your church need an armed guard? Our synagogues do, right? I mean, it is what it is right now. And the only thing we can do is just, my cure and the things that I think about for stemming some of the anti-Semitism is that I still stand up for groups of people. I believe that I don't want to get into it because it's political, but, police reform. And it's one of those things where, even though I know some people in those left-wing-ish type groups, maybe the Black Lives Matter, they will talk bad about Israel, and then I say, well, I'm Jewish, and I don't care. You could talk like that. My job is to still stand up for you right now, and I'm going to stand up for you no matter what. And that's some of the ways I feel that's going to end anti-Semitism is... by us helping, still helping others. I want to end and say something real quick. There is one of the ways we get to even use this great example is for the Irish. When you hear, if you ever hear an Irish person talking anti-Semitic, you get to say, hey, do you eat corned beef? You know, do you eat, corned beef and cabbage? Do you eat that on St. Patrick's Day? Do you? Yeah, it's great, right? You know what? You just didn't eat that in Ireland. You know who fed that to you? Us. We fed that to you when you got here and you were starving to death. And it became an Irish-American meal. It's a code. We fed that to you because we were the wave right before them, and then it was the Irish, and we fed them so they didn't starve to death. So that's the way that we get to keep doing this. We get to point out, it's not humble for us to be like, see, we did save your butts, but we did save them when they got here by giving them corned beef and cabbage. That was the cheapest meal we can feed all those people that were starving. That's a true story. That's us reaching out.
Thank you for sharing your experiences. So I'm curious, I think... and tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems like a lot of people who identify with the neo-Nazi movement also would consider themselves true patriots, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so my question is, what is the narrative they tell themselves so that Hitler, yamach shemo, is not the bad guy? Because Hitler was enemy number one for America. To me, it would seem like if they identified with the 9/11 hijackers, what are they telling themselves that they can convince themselves that they're not the bad guys in that?
No, it's hard. It's a good argument, and it is it's the same thing when they wave a Confederate flag. It's the same deal. The way that they justify it is that for one, the Jewish media has always lied about Hitler, right? So that, and that, and this is, I'm not trying to be even funny here, but this is the truth. There would have been times when I was first getting into this movement, and I would say, well, my grandpa, he fought in the war against this dude. I would see a picture of Hitler hanging somewhere, and I'd be like, my grandfather fought in the war against this guy. And it would come down to, they're like, yeah, but, you know, he was for the white race, and he really was a good dresser. I mean, it comes to a stupid thing, like, he really dressed up Germany good. He really did. And it's like, and in those little ways, I'm telling you, it kind of works for them. The same thing with the Confederate flag, you know. And they get to change the meaning. Well, he really didn't mean this by that. When they say, like, Hitler really didn't mean this, I go, you ever read Mein Kampf? He talks about the final salute. What are you talking about? Like, he talks about this. This isn't something that's taking out of context. He really meant to keep doing what he was doing. So, it's just sometimes you got to keep pounding them with the truth, and it's hard. It's a hard deal.
I think our time is up, so thank you very much.
Yes,
but
sir.
You can
sure, I'll be around.
You'll stick around for a while, and if anybody wants to ask any questions, please go ahead. Thank you.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.